Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Phillies yesterday were in this time slot. It was well worth the listen. They won, and the game winner delivered by Adam Haseley.
Two outs in the eighth, runner at first, he goes again. The pitch swung on, poked the other way, it's a base hit. Down the third base line, Kingery on his way into third base, the ball kicks away, off the side wall, Kingery's going to score. And Adam Haseley with his first major league hit has given the Phillies a 6-5 lead. Haseley at second with a double, and the Phillies have fought all the way back to take the lead here in the eighth.
2 years ago we had him on the show. Because he was with the Williamsport Crosscutters. Now, he's delivering game-winning hits in the major leagues. What a story. Andrew McCutchen out for the year, torn ACL. Right now, Adam Haseley is the guy that has the job in center field and did not hurt his cause by delivering that hit. Oh, and by the way, did you hear who scored in that play? Scott Kingery. Has he been good? Kingery has been really good.
We talk about the combination of Bryce Harper and Rhys Hoskins. Rhys has kind of been a little bit of a slump here the past few weeks, but I'll tell you what, who's really taken now with Jay Bruce in the lineup. Now you got Bruce and Kingery back-to-back. Yeah, Kingery's Kingery's got it here the last few weeks.
Yeah, he's been terrific.
Yeah, he's turned it around.
Terrific. And as Kevin Franzen was talking about the other day, he said, look, I saw it in spring training. He said he had two out of Steinbrenner Field in Tampa. You probably have not seen Steinbrenner Field. It's right next to Raymond James Stadium where the Buccaneers play. Which, you know, I've done a couple of Outback Bowls there. So I've seen the field. I mean, it is a poke to hit that ball out of there. You've got to drive it. He hit two there. So he's showing it, and you can see that Kingery is right now playing with a lot of confidence. Very impressive. That was a win they needed yesterday. They needed that win. Ooh. Wow. All right. We'll get to more of that a little bit later. The basketball rules are officially in place for the upcoming season. I think the surprise to some people is that they're going to be implemented right away. Not in Division II and Division III. They're not going to be implemented right away in Division II or Division III. Okay? But in Division I basketball, you're going to see it right away. You are going to see a three-point line at 22 feet, 1 3/4 inches. That is the international line.
Now, have you always been in favor of like a universal three-point line?
Well, this is what I've been in favor of. First of all, it should be shorter than the NBA. Because the pros are the pros. Right?
And theirs is what, 24?
23.9. Okay. And then in the corners, it's 22. Because it's only a 50-foot wide court. So you only get 3 feet in the corner with the 22s on each side. And, you know, the first time I did a game with the three-point line, back in the 80s, from 82 to the end of the 85 season, you were allowed to experiment. So there were certain times where I'd have to be asking, okay, what are the rules tonight before the game? All right, there's no shot clock, no three-point line. Okay, boom, that's how they're going to play. Or there's a shot clock, 45 seconds, no three-point line. or there's a three-point line and no shot clock, or there's a shot clock and a three-point line. That's literally the way it was. Before every game, you had to find out exactly what the deal was. And the first time I did a game with a three-point line was Penn State and Maryland at the Baltimore Civic Center in November of 82. And I mentioned how it was Len Bias' first game at Maryland. He had 10 that night. Penn State won the game by 18. 18 points. Actually, 18 points? Yeah, 97-79. Won by 18 points. And they used the, quote, ACC line for that game. It was 17 feet 9 inches. It was 2 feet inside the top of the key. Dickie Mumma ended up hitting 3 trays in the game. And I asked him after the game, I said, what did it feel like to hit 3-pointers in a game? He says, 3-pointers? What are you talking about? He didn't even know he was taking 3-point shots. He said, I was just taking my jump shot. Turned out they were behind the line. 17 feet 9 inches. Well, now that line is 4 feet, 4¾ inches further out than that ACC line. Plus some other rules. With that, we bring in Tab Boyle, head of the NCAA Rules Committee and the head basketball coach at Colorado. Coach, it's a pleasure. Welcome.
Thank you, Steve. Good to be with you.
Good to be with you. We have a mutual friend in Tom McGrath, and I told Tom last week you were going to be on the show, and he said that, and you and I both know how close Tom was with Dave Gavitt, and he said Dave Gavitt always felt it was very important for a player or coach to lead the rules committee, that if you have officials doing it, according to Dave Gavitt, changes in the game were not always going to happen in a good way. What is your perspective as a player, played at Kansas, now as a head basketball coach? How did that help you in shaping your ideas as to which way the rules should go?
You know, it's helped a lot, and I agree. I think the coaches have to have a pretty strong voice in this as we coach the game. But I also believe that, you know, and one of the things I've really enjoyed in being part of the committee and the process is the collaboration with the officials, because I think the officials need to have a voice at the table, and they do. J.D. Collins, and he always brings one of the top officials as well as a coordinator of officials to every rules committee meeting we have in May, and their input, because they're the one is administering these rules, and they've got a, I think they want the game to be better just like we want the game to be better. So I think the thing I love about the committee is the collaboration that goes on between players, officials, and administrators, whether it's athletic directors or conference administrators at the conference level. You know, everybody wants to do what's good for the game, and you mentioned guys like Dave Gavitt and Tom McGrath. Those guys care about the game of basketball as much as anybody.
No question. A year ago, Penn State won the NIT, so I watched the three-point line play out, but also with an expanded lane. When it came to the three-point line, you didn't expand the lane. What does that do, in your opinion, for spacing on the floor because the lane wasn't expanded?
Well, I think, you know, if you look at it like this, I think one of the things is the data for the three-point line is pretty clear and pretty evident. You look at percentages, you look at number of shots taken and made, the data is pretty clear. The widening of the lane data is really hard to get. I mean, you don't know, it's more of a perception, and does it, you know, does it help or does it hurt spacing? We're moving the three-point line out a foot and a half. Right. And the lane, as it was proposed, would go out 2 feet on either side. So let's just say if you're talking about the side of the floor or, you know, the slot area of the floor, you're expanding the lane by 2 feet, you're expanding the three-point line by a foot and a half, you're actually losing space. Yeah. If your assumption is there's an offensive and defensive player on each line, the three-point line and the lane line. And so we felt as a committee, you know, let's start with the three-point line, expanding that, because we know that's going to hopefully help spacing. The numbers say the percentages went down about 1 percentage point, you know, from the NIT games from last year and this year. So not a significant number. And let's see how that works and see how that affects the game. and we'll have another 2 years to kind of see that. And then if the lane widening still has some legs and still has some momentum, let's look at it at that point. But rather than doing both at the same time, just felt like it was a prudent thing to do, because the one thing we know about college basketball is we know college basketball is a great game the way it is right now. Mm-hmm. And the one thing I did not want as a coach that was not on the rules committee, and certainly I don't want now that I am on the rules committee, is to make changes just to make changes. And so I think we want to be really slow and prudent in every change that we make and how it's going to affect the game. We want it to be a positive effect, obviously.
And I agree completely with not expanding the lane yet, because I agree with you. It's like if you're bringing out one, now you're bringing the defense back out further, and it kind of negates it. We'll see how it plays out.
Right. Absolutely.
Now, the next part of this is that doing games this past season, a couple guys, and I'll give you an example. Late in the game, Penn State's playing Iowa, and you know what kind of shooter Jordy Bohannon is. And he shoots, he gets like a 25, 28 footer, knocks it down. And Dick Girardi doing the game with me, we looked at each other and said, you know what, that's actually his range. I mean, as you go through this, with the expanded 3-point line, isn't it a reality now in today's game, in your opinion, that more guys do have that kind of range?
Absolutely. A lot of people call it the Steph Curry effect, and the effect he's had on the game. And, what was interesting to me, again, we look at a lot of data, and I'll tell you, you mentioned, my days at Kansas. I graduated from Kansas in 1985. We did not have the three-point line. It came into effect in 1986.
Right.
In 1986, the average Division I team attempted 9 three-point shots a game the first year it came in. Mm-hmm. This past year, I think that number was between 22 and 23. So it just shows you the effect that they're attempting a lot more of them. And you mentioned the range of players today. I don't think you're going to see a significant drop, especially after players have a chance after a year or two of adjusting, because a lot of players have range. I don't think the three-point shot as it was necessarily worth 3 points. And we'll see, what this new change does in terms of percentages nationwide.
Next part of this deals with an offensive rebound. Instead of being recycled to 30, it would recycle to 20. That also was used in the NIT. The NBA goes from 24 to 14 now. You're already across the timeline past the 10 seconds anyway. What was the rationale about doing this move? Do you think it can speed up the game?
Speed up the game, more possessions, more scoring were all the thoughts. And you mentioned the 10 seconds. In college basketball, we have 10 seconds to get the ball from the backcourt to the front court. Well, if the ball's already in the front court and you get an offensive rebound, we're basically saying, hey, that 10 seconds that you needed to get across half court, is not needed. Because it's not only just on an offensive rebound, but even if it's on let's say, a missed free throw and the offense gets the rebound, or the ball gets tipped back and is controlled in the front court, the shot will be reset to 20 as well. So a couple different scenarios where it goes back to 20. But basically the rationale was you don't need the 10 seconds in the front court to get the ball into the front court. It's already there, so let's just reset it to 20.
Final 2 minutes, and by the way, and everybody ought to get the software for it, because I remember a year ago, the opening round of the NIT, Baylor couldn't do it because they didn't have the software and the scoreboard to do it.
Right.
So that happened.
Yeah.
Next part is allowing coaches to call timeouts themselves during a live ball situation, the final 2 minutes of both the second half and, if it turns out, any overtime.
Yeah, that was a lot of discussion, and I think every coach in the room felt like, hey, we want to be able to call timeouts. This is a great example of where I think officials kind of weighed in, and the one play that was very, very difficult for officials to officiate, and quite frankly was impossible to do, was when there's a loose ball on the floor, as happens in college basketball, and players are trying to gain control of it, and you've got a coach, maybe with an official right in front of him yelling timeout, timeout, and that official blows his whistle to grant a timeout, and really possession's not been determined yet. And another official might be happening across the court is looking and, whose ball is it? And there really is no control of the ball. The whole whole idea of not letting coaches time out to call timeout was to get rid of that play and the inequities of that play. And it would happen at critical points of the game. We've decided in the last 2 minutes, you know, if coaches want to call a timeout, I think officials are going to look at that play and be very reluctant to grant a timeout until the ball is controlled. But that was a great example of the collaboration between coaches and officials to say, hey, how can we get kind of the best of both worlds? Because I think a lot of coaches felt like, you know, at the end of the games, changing defenses, that sort of thing, they want the ability to help their players and call timeouts, and that's what we came up with. So we'll see how that works.
Right. When it comes to basket interference or goaltending, again, final 2 minutes or the final 2 minutes of overtime, it can now become reviewable. My opinion's always been on goaltending. I've always felt that any ball that, if it hit the backboard, you're trying to determine whether it hit the backboard or not. I always felt that was reviewable, should be reviewable, because there's so many cameras around the thing. How difficult is this one? I know it's only the final 2 minutes and the final 2 minutes of overtime. On a ball where you're trying to determine the arc of it.
Well, here's number one. It's the most difficult play to call, not only live, but yeah, even on replay. I mean, how many times, even if on replay, you're like, oh, was it at the apex or not? Was it on the way down? I mean, it's a difficult play to call regardless. Now, the thing to understand is this is only reviewable if a whistle is blown.
Okay.
So, that's another example of officials in the room that really helped coaches, because I think everybody, the layman says, that should be reviewable. You know, everybody talks about the Kentucky LSU game.
Right.
Okay, the Kentucky LSU game, that should be reviewable. Well, there was no goaltending called. There was right. No basket interference called. Well, if you want that to be reviewable on a no call, you're going to open up a can of worms that people don't realize.
Yeah.
And that is, the officials are going to blow the whistle and go to the monitor to see, was it a goaltending or was it not? Well, when they blow the whistle, when the shot is blocked, whose ball is it?
Right.
And you could get a situation where they blow the whistle, it was a legitimate block, and now they go to the arrow, and the offense gets the ball back.
Right.
And if the whistle's not blown, right, they block the shot, and maybe they're going down to score 2 points on the other end. So you've actually penalized the defense by a great defensive play,
right,
by putting a replay rule in. Because what's the official going to do if it's close?
Right.
They're going to blow the whistle and go to the monitor.
Right. Exactly.
We don't want that. So that's why it is reviewable only if the official blew the whistle.
And, by the way, only in the final 2 minutes or the final 2 minutes.
And only in the final 2 minutes of the game, exactly.
You're right.
Exactly.
Was there any discussion, as you said earlier, a lot of elements of this game are great as they are. Complete agreement there. Was there any discussion at all about quarters?
There was discussion on quarters. It was a little bit of a non-starter, just not because people don't want it or don't think it's good for the game. It's just that with the contracts that are in place right now with media partners, you know, both at the conference level and certainly, with the NCAA tournament, trying to fit all the inventory of the commercials in to a quarter system is very, very difficult, very choppy, doesn't let the game flow, extends the time of the games. Again, this was experimented in the NIT, as you yep. know, over the last couple of years. So, again, looked at the data there and just felt like that's not the direction that is best for the game of college basketball right now as it stands.
Completely.
Doesn't mean it won't happen in the future, though.
Right. No, I understand that, but I do completely agree with that. I think that's exactly the way it should go. Hey, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it, you know, and I think you gave everybody a really great perspective as usual, and hopefully our paths will cross again along the line. I think the last time I was around you was probably that tournament in Las Vegas a couple, 3 years ago, so in Penn State.
Yeah, that's
Colorado.
Right.
Yep.
I remember that. So I appreciate your time, and thanks for all you do.
Hey, thank you, Coach. Thanks for all you do. We appreciate it.
Okay.
Tad Boyle, head basketball coach, Colorado, head of the NCAA Basketball Rules Committee. We'll come back with more in a moment on News Radio 1070 WKOK. When it comes to car buying, there's the other guy's way, and then there's the SMC way. The other guys force you into a vehicle you really don't want. The Sunbury Motors way lets you take the time you need to browse, ask questions, and take the test drive and think on it. For over 100 years, the Mertz family and all their employees have made your experience the most pleasant one you'll ever have. The other guys won't offer you the best price for your trade, no matter how much they say they will. The SMC way is their promise to provide you with the most money the market shows your vehicle is worth. The SMC way is to offer you all applicable factory rebates on new vehicles and generous discounts. Looking for a pre-owned vehicle? The SMC way checks each vehicle in a 200-mile radius to determine the lowest price, then beat it. It's the lowest price promise, just part of the SMC way. The choice is up to you. The other guy's way or the SMC way? The SMC way wins every time. Sunbury Motors Company in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, and at sunburymotors.com. Selling more cars and satisfying more customers for over 100 years.
The Steve Jones Show is available right on your smartphone with the Steve Jones Show podcast. Visit the Google Play or Apple Podcast app and search Steve Jones Show. Then click subscribe to have every Steve Jones Show sent right to your smartphone. Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Great to have you with us. Earlier on our play-by-play call of the day, Adam Haseley delivered his first major league hit. It turned out to be the game winner at Petco yesterday over the San Diego Padres. Andrew McCutchen went down with a torn ACL. The Phillies then bought Haseley's contract. Well, he was the first round pick of the Phillies 2 years ago this week out of Virginia. They sent him to Williamsport, where he played for the Cutters. So 2 years ago, when he was just cutting his teeth on the professional level in the New York Penn League, little did we know that 710 days later, he'd be playing in the major leagues, delivering game-winning hits, and he joined us on the show. Current Williamsport cross-cutter Adam Haseley joins us. Eighth overall pick in the draft. Phillies first-round pick, off to a great start with the Cutters after going through the GCL with complete ease. Adam, welcome to the show. Welcome to the area. It's great to have you with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me. Happy to be here.
All right, let's start with this, Adam. Your parents, I believe Dan and Mary Kay, I believe are their names, actually came out and finally had a chance to watch you play, and when they did, you homered.
They did. They came out Friday afternoon. They were there for Friday and Saturday, and it was actually my dad's birthday on Saturday. So it was just a cool couple days, and the first night that he was there, that homer happened.
I have to correct myself. I think his name is Rich. It's Rich and Mary Kay.
Yes, it is.
Haseley.
Rich.
And then some youngsters got the ball, and what did they do with it? Instead of keeping it, what did they do?
I saw them after the game, and at first they wanted me to sign it or whatever, and then they told me that it was the actual home run ball. So I asked them if I could switch it out with one that I had in my locker, and they said yeah. And so I actually got to get the ball for myself, and then I ended up giving it to my dad, kind of like a birthday present.
It's a great birthday present. You pitched, and not only that, you were a really good pitcher with Virginia, ninth in the nation in ERA. Who was it that told you, though, that, you know what, if you play the field, that really is your path? Who told you that and why?
Well, I think it was a number of people. It was also kind of my decision, really. Playing the field is something that I've always really enjoyed doing, and I enjoyed pitching too, but I just, found more excitement and joy in just being able to play every day and getting to hit. And so that's really kind of what made the decision. And pitching had always been kind of secondary, and going into college, I didn't pitch my freshman year. And then my second and third year, I was able to pitch a little bit more. But, in the back of my mind, I always wanted to hit, if I ever got a chance to go into pro ball.
Yeah, well, you were only second in the ACC in ERA. You were eighth in wins, and you were ninth in the nation in ERA. So, obviously, that little dalliance in the pitching wasn't that bad.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I really did. It was something that, you know, there's nothing really like it when you're in the game. And you know, the only, I guess, drawback is all the kind of extra work you have to do for both pitching and hitting.
I want to ask you about the transition from college now to playing pro ball. What are some differences, not just in the game itself, but really even off the field? What are some of the differences between being a pro and in college?
I think the biggest thing, honestly, is just routines. And, you know, if you can solidify a routine for yourself from day to day, then it's something that you know you can look forward to and rely on. And, you know, college, you have different classes at different times and different events and things like that. And, you know, pro ball is just kind of know what you're going to have the next day. And, you know, it's something that you can just rely on when you wake up, you know, what your schedule is going to be.
15 players from this draft that you were in are now playing for Williamsport. Has this really been a bonding experience for the draft choices looking ahead down the road as a group together?
Yeah, it has. I got there a little bit late down in Clearwater after the draft, and you know, most of those guys came up here while I was still down in Clearwater. But, you know, when I came up here, they welcomed me back, and it's just been really cool to bond with them, like you said, and get to play these games with them. And, you know, I hope we can all just continue to move.
All right, now let's get to the going into Williamsport. As you know, they put $4 million into that ballpark. Those are Major League dugouts, Major League Baseball paid for the field that you're playing on, all part of this August 20th game between the Pirates and the Cardinals. What's been your impression of being there, and what do you think it means to the organization to have that kind of facility now?
The surface, I mean, it's just the first thing you can tell when you go play in the outfield is you know, amazing, and it's all level, and it's everything is just perfectly cut, and you know, it's just, I don't know, it's just a blessing to be able to play on, you know, that kind of surface. You know, and I wasn't here, and I didn't hear anything about the old surface or stadium, but I'm just really excited that, you know, I had the chance and the other guys had the chance to play on that kind of field.
All right, you go from one level to the next. Any adjustment from one level to the next for you? Anything that's just a little bit different here than you saw in the brief period of time you were in the GCL?
I think, you know, as you keep moving up, the pitching is going to get better and better, obviously. And, you know, arms are just going to be that much better, and guys can locate a little bit better. And the secondary stuff will be, you know, just a step above where, you know, you previously came from. And you know, the hitting, too, and the fielding, too, is going to be, you know, better, and guys are going to be hitting the ball farther and faster. And I don't know. I think it's just something the guys are going to be older, and it's something you have to adjust to.
Growing up, what other sports interested you?
Growing up, I played basketball, played football a little bit, but it was mostly basketball and baseball growing up.
And then what finally just swung you to baseball, just how good you were at it, or was there something else?
I wasn't really good at basketball. It's pretty short, kind of small. so I think it was by default that I had to pick baseball.
Well, they couldn't make you the 6'1 point guard.
No. By that time, I was in the five somewhere.
In the fives ain't going to make it unless you're Muggsy Bogues. So.
Right.
So I make sure we know that. So when you finally got going at this thing, who were the influences on you that made a difference in teaching, maybe even made an outside influence on you as you came through this thing, as you developed?
You know, I think it's a combination of coaches, college coaches at Virginia, Coach Kuhn, Coach McMullen, Coach Kirby, Coach Brian O'Connor. You know, I think those guys played an immense role in you know, helping me learn the game and mature in the game. And then, you know, I've had some mentors and some guys that have been really pouring into me from, you know, just a kind of a spiritual aspect too. I come from a faith-based home, and I think just a combination of those two things kind of set me up for, you know, be able to have success in college and, you know, being where I am now.
was talking with Daniel Castano of State College the other day when I had him on the pregame show here, and same thing. He talked about faith-based and what it has meant for him. What has faith-based meant for you off the field, and what kind of influence is it, maybe even a calming influence on the field?
Off the field, I think it just sets me up as the man that I want to be. How I treat people, how I, handle my family, and the relations that I have off the field, and on the field too. It just kind of takes a little bit of the pressure off that. I feel like I'm playing for a bigger purpose, and it's not just all about me. And it's, I was given these abilities to, kind of glorify the person that gave them to me. And, that's just something that I kind of play in freedom with, that I have this ability, and now I just get to play.
Does it take the pressure off of being, hey, look, that's Adam Haseley. He's the first pick of the Phillies. Hey, that's Adam Haseley. He's the 8th overall pick in the draft. Has the faith part of it allowed you to put all that in perspective?
I think big picture it has. There's going to be some obvious immediate attention of, some of it that I didn't really even see coming. I never really thought I'd be, where I am today. And but big picture wise, I think there's a long plan here, and I'm just going to continue to focus on myself and just try to keep things light and big picture.
All right. In college, obviously, you have a routine. You go to class, then it would be baseball in the afternoon, could be a game, could be a practice. In the fall, there's fall baseball as well. Now, what's your routine as a professional? How do you spend that off time?
Are you speaking about the off season?
No, I'm talking about like now. I realize there's certain times, now this is an off day, but there are certain times, where you have to be at the ballpark and so forth. But you're now out of the college routine, where instead of going to class, you've got to fill it with other things. How do you try to fill that extra time?
I think there's just more time to do, some hobbies and try to get away from baseball as much as you can. This morning, I actually went fishing with, a couple guys. Austin Bastille was one of them. Just try to get away, from the everyday grind of playing games. And so I think there's different things you do. You just try to stay relaxed and go to dinner with some guys or try to get away and go hiking or fishing or whatever you have to do. Some mornings or some days, you just got to get your mind off of the game.
So are you an outdoors guy?
A little bit, yeah. I grew up on a lake a little bit and close to a beach. So, I enjoy the water, like fishing.
Okay. All right. So is it a secret spot you went to today? And if not, where was it? And did you catch anything?
We did not actually land a fish. We went fly fishing for the first time. But it was a little cold in the water. We didn't go at the best time. Went at like 9. So we didn't really plan it out too well. But, we went with actually one of Austin's host parents' friends actually took us. And I really couldn't tell you where it went. It was off in a trail somewhere. And we were just lining up on a riverbank. So if we were to do it again, we probably should have done it at night. And when they were feeding, but it was all good.
Well, maybe at some point I got to get you hooked up with Joe Humphreys, one of the foremost fly fishermen in the country. He's here in State College. The long list of big names that have come out to fish with him, you'd love it. But that'll be for another time, another place.
There you go.
Okay. One final question, I'll let you go. As you move forward with this, where in the last period of time do you feel like you've improved your game, where you feel like you're a little more comfortable, where you feel like you're getting a little better? Where is that right now and why?
Mental consistency, I think, is the best thing that I've been working on a lot in this spring, in the winter. And it's really been tested, I think. Just playing every day, it's tough to be locked in and focused every day, but I want to, keep working at it, keep bringing my best, mental focus I can each and every day. And, I think if you do that, that's, more than half the battle is just being locked in. So I'd say mental consistency.
I lied about the last question. This will be the last question. I was talking with Tim Frazier, who played last year with the New Orleans Pelicans in the NBA, and he was traded to the Washington Wizards a couple weeks ago. And he said, in going through the NBA schedule, he said one thing that really struck him was that all of a sudden you get to the middle of December, and you played 30-some-odd games and realize that's how many games I played in college. I still got 50 games to go. Now, I realize in college baseball there's a 50-60-game schedule, but is there a grind to this everyday part that you as a young player have to get used to?
I think there's no doubt a grind to this thing, and I've only been doing it for 2 weeks, and you know some guys have been playing since March or whenever spring training had ended and the seasons had started, and it's every day. I mean, it's seriously every day. It's a grind. It's you can't take a day off, and it's much more of a grind than colleges. You get a couple, 3 or 4 days off a week, and it's something you can't really prepare for until you're in it. So it's something that I'm trying to get accustomed to and trying to get used to.
Absolute pleasure. Thanks so much on your off day for giving us your valuable time, Adam. I appreciate it. I wish you nothing but the best of luck, not only this summer, but as you make your way through the system.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
And that way through the system for Adam Haseley has landed him in the major leagues and a game-winning hit last night in San Diego, or yesterday afternoon in San Diego. That was our interview with Adam Haseley 2 years ago in the show when he was a member of the Williamsport Crosscutters. We'll wrap it up in a moment on News Radio 1070 WKOK, brought to you by Sunbury Motors. All right, special on the mark coming up tomorrow. On the mark tomorrow is going to take a look at resiliency and wood mode. So it's a special on the mark coming up tomorrow. Absolutely invite you to tune in to it tomorrow. And be another outstanding show. We'll have Dick Girardi on our show tomorrow talking about the Belmont Stakes. War of Will will be in the field, but I can tell you as a preview in talking with Dick that he is not very high on War of Will. He was very high of him on him going into the Preakness. Very much so. But that's a mile and 3/16. Not enamored with War of Will going a mile and a half. We'll get into that with Dick tomorrow. If you're wondering where the executive vice president in charge of digital media is right now, he's, I believe, listening to the show and just made a move to local parlor. Can I take back all my money? I mean, I don't know about you, but like normally, I've tried to encourage the suit over the years with some of his wagering habits.
Yeah,
to watch the sting. So place it on Lucky Dan. I put it all on Lucky Dan to win. No, I said place. I said place. That horse is going to run second. I want my money back. I want my money back.
Speaking of horses, when is this going to end? I just read that the 27th horse
died at
Santa Anita out in California.
I don't know.
We're going on 6-7 months of this now.
I know. And I don't know what to say about it. I've talked to Dick about it. He doesn't know what to say about it. He went out to, he was at Sardi's with Dave Johnson, who might be the greatest horse racing announcer ever. And down the stretch they come. Dave is, I've had, because of Dick, and Dick and I have gone together, I've gone with him, but I've had dinner now a few times with Dave Johnson. Incredible guy. Right? Great announcer, better guy. Okay? And that nobody, Dave always has his event pre-Belmont at Sardi's. Dick says nobody knows what the heck the is going on out there. Nobody. It's a shame. absolute shame. You're talking about 27 horses dying.
And this one was just leisurely jogging on the track.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. And that's been one of the great tracks going. I don't know. But in the answer to that, you know, but in the answer to that, obviously, I would mention it right away. Dante Biasi, by the way, was drafted in the sixth round by the Kansas City Royals. You know, his brother was also drafted by the Royals. His brother's now in the Sal is now in the Brewers organization, but he was also drafted by the Royals. But Dante Biasi was the sixth round pick of the Royals in the draft this week.
Roy Halladay's son, taken by Toronto.
And 32nd round, awesome, except he is going to keep his commitment and he is going to come to Penn State. He signed his letter of intent in November, and he thanked the Blue Jays for doing it, that it meant a lot that they did it, but he's going to honor his commitment and come to Penn State.
And also, I'll throw this out here real quick. Lock Haven Mill Hall native Alex Garbrick, he was on the 2011 Keystone team in the Little League World Series. 40th round yesterday, was drafted by the New York Yankees. He's a right-handed pitcher for Morehead State.
Well, I think he might end up with Staten Island. He might be pitching in the New York Penn League, and Staten Island plays at State College this year. How about that? College pitcher, as a college pitcher, he might end up at Staten Island. Dick Girardi on the show tomorrow on the Belmont Stakes. We know the suit will be listening. $20 bills in hand.
Your station for news, weather, business, and CBS Sports Radio. News Radio 1070 WKOK Sunbury and on WKOK.com.